Tonight I want to start in on a subject which is too big to be completed in the one meeting. It's the mark of the beast. You remember the reference in Revelation to the fact that there comes a time when everyone must receive the mark of the beast in his right hand or in his forehead. Otherwise, he's boycotted, he can't buy or sell, and so on. And like most things in the Bible, there's been an awful lot of utter rot preached about it by clergymen who don't know anything about the subject but insist on talking about it just the same. The book of Revelation, as I think all of you know, is entirely symbolic. And therefore, unless you are sure that you get the right key to the symbols, you can't possibly get the correct understanding of what it's talking about. So before we get down to that part of it, it's time that we understood what our symbols are, and then we'll know what we are talking about. The Bible offers the key, and it offers the only key, to the symbols it uses. Lots of people undertake to try to decipher the symbolism of the Bible, and they go elsewhere than to the Bible itself for their information, and they're invariably wrong. Sometimes they try to do it out of their own cleverness, that they can figure this thing out. Sometimes they take Hindu or Egyptian or other pagan religions as the basis of their starting point, and they're always wrong. There is one place only where you can get the correct key to the symbolism of the Bible, and that is out of the Bible itself. Now, what we're going to talk about is a beast, and it's a very odd beast, obviously symbolic of something. Well, the book of Revelation is at the very end of the Bible, so we're going to have to look earlier into the Bible to find the key. And the first place we find where it's obviously talking about a very closely related beast is in the book of Daniel. And that's very appropriate because the book of Daniel is so deeply symbolic. It makes its first appearance in Daniel. Now, you remember that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and it impressed him so greatly it woke him up. And then when he woke up, he found he'd forgotten the dream. He remembered only that it was a thing of obviously great importance, and it worried him. This is in the second chapter of the book of Daniel. So King Nebuchadnezzar called in the wise men to interpret his dream for him. And they said, well, tell us the dream and we'll tell you the significance. And when he said, I've forgotten it, you tell me what the dream was, he punctured their bubble right then and there. They were pretending, of course, to be wise men and magicians and to have divine power and all that kind of thing, and they couldn't make good. So we had them killed, but Daniel said, well, don't be too hasty on this thing now. Give me a little time, and I believe God will give me the understanding of it, which he did. So Daniel interpreted the dream. He told him what the dream was and the interpretation of it. And that dream, you remember, was first of this great statue or image, which had a head of gold, the breast and arms of silver, the belly and thighs of brass, the legs were of iron, and the feet were mixed iron and clay. Now, Daniel interpreted this for him. He said, this shows four successive kingdoms, each of which is going to rule the then known civilized world in its turn. The head of gold was Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar. The silver and breast the breast and arms of silver were another kingdom which would come next. and would be somewhat inferior in its degree of civilization to Babylon. And we know that, of course, to be the Medo-Persian Empire. Then he said the belly and thighs of brass would be yet another kingdom, and we know that that was Alexander the Great's short-lived empire. And finally, the iron legs represented one more kingdom. And there's something in particular you need to note about that last kingdom, the iron one of Rome, because it keeps coming up again. In Daniel 2, verse 40, he said, "And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things, as iron that breaks all these shall it break in pieces and bruise." And that language is significant because we keep coming back to that. Now, when Daniel interpreted this vision, the time was pretty close to 580 B.C., within a few years one way or another of this. Babylon was at that time under its greatest king, Nebuchadnezzar, at the very apex of its power and its civilization. Two kings later, it came to its end about 538 B.C. Now, the head of gold, no question, that was the Babylonian Empire, which was then in existence. Now, the next one, which would come after it, he said, this was the breast and arms, sure of silver. Well, now, the Medo-Persian Empire, two arms united in the one breast, two kingdoms, Media and Persia, united in the one empire. Media was the more northwesterly of the two. It came to great power first. Later, it was, in its turn, conquered and absorbed by Persia, and the united empire, but under a Persian king, was the one which conquered Babylon. Its power became very great. It extended from northwest India and Afghanistan across the whole Fertile Crescent, the nations that extend in a great arch north of the Arabian Desert. In other words, from the head of the Persian Gulf on up through Iraq and Iran, as we call them today. But then you see the Babylonian and Assyrian empires, over into Syria, down the coast through Palestine. It took in a good deal of Asia Minor, which today we call Turkey, and even conquered and ruled Egypt for a time. So, starting this tremendous rise with the conquest of Babylon about 538 B.C., this empire ruled all the important parts of the known civilized world at that time, until it was conquered by Alexander the Great between 334 and 331 B.C. Then that was followed by the empire of Alexander the Great. He had been king of Macedonia, which is on the mainland just north of the peninsula of Greece. And in 336 B.C., he was merely king of Macedonia. The Greeks had a very high civilization and one fatal weakness. They never could get along among themselves. They were always fighting among themselves, the various Greek cities, because each of them represented an individual nation as they were then organized. And in their bitter warfare, whoever was losing was always ready to call in somebody else as an ally to keep from losing the war. And when you called in a powerful nation in those days to help, It simply meant that not only did they conquer your opponent, but they swallowed you up too. And of course, that's exactly what happened. In some of their bitter internal warfare, some of the Greeks called in the Macedonians to their aid, and Alexander had a very well-trained and brilliantly commanded army. There are two men in all past history who stand out as generals of ability beyond any other. One is Alexander the Great, and the other is Hannibal of Carthage. And it's perhaps a toss-up which was the more brilliant from a military point of view. So, under Alexander's leadership, the Macedonian army was irresistible. So he simply conquered and took over the various Greek cities and incorporated them into his beginning empire, and then went on looking for more worlds to conquer. He conquered Asia Minor, Syria, and Palestine by 332 BC. He conquered the Tigris-Euphrates valleys, making up the old Assyrian and Babylonian empires, by 331 BC. And he went on to conquer Media, Persia, what was then called Bactria, and today we call it Afghanistan. It lies just outside of India, just north of the famous Khyber Pass. It's the gateway to India. And went on down into northern India, conquering quite a considerable area in northern India. So that all the then known civilized world, from Greece to India, was incorporated in his one empire. And you remember, before his death, he was mooning around, worrying because there were no more worlds left to conquer. A brilliant general, and that's all you can say for him, a debauched drunkard also, and he finally died of his dissipation in Babylon in 323 B.C. Now, he had built nothing. He conquered, and as an individual king, backed up by a victorious army, he ruled the conquered nations. And when he died, there was nothing to hold it together. His empire broke up, and exactly as had been prophesied in Daniel, that his kingdom would be divided to the four winds of heaven and not to his posterity, because his four leading generals under him each took over approximately a quarter of the empire where they were, and in those few years, between 334, you might say, and 323 B.C., this enormous empire was built and fell apart. So you've got Babylon, Medo-Persia, Alexander's empire, and now the next in line and the last in this series of Gentile empires that was prophesied by Daniel, Rome. The city itself was founded, according to their tradition, in 753 B.C. The Republic of Rome was organized about 500 B.C., and with the organization of the Republic began its expansion into a tremendous empire. Macedonia, Greece, and Egypt were incorporated into the empire in 168 B.C., and from there they moved on into Western Asia, North Africa, and on, of course, into a good deal of Western Europe. Eventually, the Roman Empire ruled Italy, Spain, what they then called Gaul, which was France and extending very slightly into Germany, Macedonia, Greece, Egypt, North Africa, Western Asia Minor, Syria, Palestine. Its frontiers were the Atlantic Ocean, the Irish Sea, the south border of Scotland, the North Sea, the River Rhine, the Danube River, the Black Sea, the Caucasus Mountains, through Armenia to the middle of ancient Babylonia, the Arabian Desert, the Red Sea, Nubia, and the Sahara Desert and the Morocco Mountains. Those were its boundaries. Now the image, of course, had two legs, and so the Roman Empire broke up into two. It was divided into a Western and Eastern Roman Empire from about 283 A.D. The capital of the eastern portion of the empire was set up in what had been called Byzantium, and being rebuilt, modernized, made into a tremendous city by Constantine, had its name changed to Constantinople. And that remained the capital of the eastern half of the Roman Empire. Now, while it claimed at all times to be the capital of the Roman Empire, you find it's generally spoken of as the Byzantine Empire, from the old, long-known name of Byzantium for its capital city. The western portion of it, which gradually was losing its hold on Europe, had its capital part of the time, but not all of it, in Rome. For example, the city of Ravenna in Italy was capital for a time. This was broken by the Visigoths, who were Israel people on the march, in 410 A.D. You remember, under the pressure of the invading Visigoths, the Romans pulled the last of their legions of soldiers out of Britain, bringing them home for the defense of Rome in 408 A.D. That year, they succeeded in buying off the Visigoth invaders. They had come into northern Italy, but they hadn't yet taken the city of Rome. They bought them off with a big money bribe. But by 410 A.D., the Visigoths had spent the money, so they took the city of Rome, looted it, and, oh, they smashed everything but a merely theoretical pretense that any further Roman Empire in the West existed. However, the Romans suggested to them, they were a wily people, that there were some wonderful lands, part of the old Roman Empire. Why don't you go move into them? There's some beautiful, fertile country over in Spain. We'll give it to you. Only don't stay here. Well, it seemed like a good idea to the Visigoths. Centuries of frightful misrule under the Roman emperors had reduced Italy to such a stage of poverty and general falling apart, there wasn't much worth staying for there anyway. So the Visigoths moved out across southern France, through the Pyrenees, and into Spain. And from, sometime a little before 420 A.D., until the Moorish conquest in 711 A.D., the Visigoths were the dominant people in Spain. Now, they didn't exterminate all the previous inhabitants of Spain, and in fact, some of the previous inhabitants of Spain were Israel people, for that matter, because the Vandals, the tribe who had moved down there from southern Scandinavia, were already in there. And they were not driven out immediately. They were not very numerous, and they later moved out into North Africa, where, of course, they were swept up in the Arab and Moorish empire later there, and became extinct, that is, they were absorbed into the darker peoples there. But in Spain then, you have a definitely Israel people, the Visigoths, as the ruling race, Portugal too at that time, the ruling race until conquered by the Moors. So that you will find in Spain today some people of Israel ancestry. Now, unlike the Scandinavian countries, which never were overrun by non-Israel invaders who left their blood behind, and therefore the Scandinavian peoples are a pure Israel stock, you cannot say of Italy or of Spain that as a nation they are Israel, because they're not. There's too many other people there. But you can say that among them are many who are definitely of Israel ancestry. The Eastern Empire, the Western Roman Empire, came to its end. All pretense of being an empire was abandoned by 476 A.D. The Eastern or Byzantine half of the Roman Empire was reduced to Asia Minor and the Balkan states by Muslim power by 650 A.D. The Turks captured most of Asia Minor by 1074 A.D. Between 1204 and 1260, the so-called Latin Empire of Constantinople, made up of the troops of the Fourth Crusade and the Republic of Venice, ruled briefly over the remaining territory, but the old Byzantine Empire was restored, at least in theory, actually governing nothing but Constantinople and its suburbs, in the middle 1260s. And the last trace of it disappeared with the capture of Constantinople by the Turks in 453 A.D. Now, the first of these visions of Daniel, of this series of four great world empires, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Alexander of Macedon, and Rome, was given in the vision of the great statue, the image of the four different metals. Now, this was so important because, remember, the great bulk of recorded history is covered by this series of empires. That the thing was given again in a different vision to Daniel. For this we go to the seventh chapter of Daniel, and here now is where we start getting into these remarkable beasts. Daniel saw this vision himself. He said, four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse from one another. Now, as you know, the sea, as used in the Bible, is symbolic of people in the great mass, non-Israel people. So out of the great mass of non-Israel people, the Gentile empires in the true sense, you had four great beasts different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and he was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon its feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now, the word man in this particular sentence is the Chaldean word enosh, which is derived from the same root as your Hebrew word enosh, which distinguishes the non-Adamic peoples from the Adamic. See, wherever the Adamic peoples are mentioned, the Hebrew word Adam is used. Now, there is the word Ish, which means simply a male person of any race, and is used sometimes referring to Adamic people. But wherever the word Enosh is used, It is speaking of non-Israel people, and it is speaking generally in a rather derogatory sense. Now, I mentioned it was the Chaldean word. You remember that in the book of Daniel, it is written partly in Hebrew and partly in Aramaic. Now, the portions of the book that pertain to the non-Israelite peoples are written in the much more widely used Aramaic language, which took in everything from southern Babylonia, way on up through the Fertile Crescent, through Assyria, Syria. In other words, it was spoken everywhere in Western Asia, other than in the earlier days in Palestine, when the related but not quite identical Hebrew language was used. So Daniel's vision of the first of these beasts that came out of the sea, it was like a lion. The eagle's wings were plucked off. It was made to stand erect on its hind feet like an Enosh man, and it was given the heart of an Enosh man. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had on the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now remember what was said about that fourth empire of Rome, the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all these things, as iron that breaks all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. So here again, this had iron teeth, was terribly strong. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped upon the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. Clearly again, a vision of the same succession of empires, and again making clear that this was Rome by a similarity of certain identifying features in the symbolism of it. Then the angel explained to Daniel the meaning of this vision. He said, These great beasts, which are four, are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. Daniel said, Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, and his nails of brass, which devoured and broke in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet. So the angel explains it. Thus, he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of the kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall rise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and shall subdue 3 kings. Now you can go into some further symbolism in here if you need to follow this up, but for the present we don't. We've identified previously these different kingdoms in this succession of empires, so I'm not going to bother trying to identify each of the 10 horns and so forth now. We have other things to cover, but let's go back. The first kingdom was like a lion. And you remember in the vision of the great statue, it was the head, which was of gold, superior to the others in its degree of culture. Likewise, the power, the lion being the most powerful of the great beasts, it was a great military power with high civilization, but had only the characteristics of the Amish. They lacked entirely the spiritual capacity of the people of Israel, with all their faults. Now the second kingdom, you remember, was like a bear, and it raised itself up on one side. Well, that's the Medo-Persian Empire. Originally Media, north of Persia proper, which was the leading kingdom during the first stage of the rise of this empire. Because as they expanded westward, they first shattered and absorbed the empire of Assyria, which lay north of Babylon. And that was done under the dominance of Media. Then Persia gained the dominance. So it raised itself up on one side. In other words, Media and Persia were not equal. The unequal power of two kingdoms in one. And it said there were three ribs in its mouth. It conquered and absorbed three great empires, Assyria, Babylon, and Egypt. So your identification here is unmistakable. Now the third empire, the third beast that came up out of the sea of these Enosh peoples, was like a leopard. And certainly you couldn't have taken a better symbol. The swift, striking, terrible power. Now he said it had four wings and four heads. In other words, already, while it was still a single empire under Alexander, it had in it the seeds of its breakup into four parts. And dominion was given unto it. Yes, dominion it certainly had. Alexander conquered all that the previous empires had ruled. You see, he occupied and conquered Egypt. Then he went on to take over all that the empires of Assyria, Babylon, and Medo-Persia had ruled, including portions of northern India. Finally, the fourth one, a beast that was dreadful, terrible, strong exceedingly, and he would devour the whole earth. Well, it covered all the then known world, all that was civilized enough to be known at that time. All but the easternmost portion of the earlier empires. Rome didn't penetrate into Afghanistan, or as they called it, Bactria then, or Egypt. But it had everything west of that. Then it had what the other empires had never had. It had all of Europe except Germany. It had northern Africa. It was excluded from all the principal lands then occupied by the people of Israel. It only overran England, where the Israel people were as yet very few in number, because the bulk of the Israel people had not come into England. There were only a tiny handful there before the withdrawal of the Roman legions. It said it broke in pieces and devoured. And remember, as Daniel 2 verse 40 said, the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things, as iron that breaks all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. Then Daniel said this fourth beast was diverse or different from all that went before it. It was. It originated as a republic. Now remember, when you had republics known in Greece before this time, they were small cities, they were not great empires. This is the first time in all history that you had a republic rising to the power of a conquering empire. As a kingdom, it kept its identity in force after the death of even its most powerful king. The others tended to weaken and sometimes even break up when a great and powerful king died. But in Rome, you had a continuity of the empire as such for these many centuries. So this next vision now obviously concerns the same four empires. But now you've got a tie-in with the book of Revelation, because you have these four beasts rising out of the sea. As we shall notice when we get to the book of Revelation, where John was given the vision, it was one beast which rose out of the sea, but the one beast combined in itself the characteristics of the first four. So obviously you've got a connection there which can't be overlooked. Now, by way of more confirmation of this order, in the 8th chapter of Daniel, he was given another vision of a ram and a goat. He said, "Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. Then I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will, and became great. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with anger against him, and smote the ram, and broke his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him. And there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones, called the four winds of heaven." So the angel gives him the explanation of this. Now remember, this is prophecy before it happened. This is while Babylon was still at the apex of its power. The angel says, "The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power." Well, this was sometime in the middle third of the 500s B.C. 550, 545, somewhere in there. And the fall of Babylon did not come till about 538 B.C. So this was two centuries now before the rise of Alexander the Great. Now notice again the accuracy of prophecy. The ram had two horns, Media and Persia. Both were high, but one was higher, and the higher one came up last. Persia was the one that came to power later, absorbing Media. The rough goat. The cultured Greeks despised the Macedonians as being barbarians. Of course, for that matter, the Greeks despised absolutely everybody else in the world as being barbarians because they recognized only two classes, Greeks and barbarians. But anyway, they looked down upon the Macedonians, maybe more than some of the others, because these were a rough, tough bunch. And when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And Alexander died at the very height of his power, 323 B.C. Now you remember in the earlier vision of the four beasts that came out of the sea, Alexander had been compared there to a leopard. I take this that I'm going to read now from the History of Nations, published by P.F. Collier and Sons. Alexander was one of the generals who win by rapid strokes and daring expedients. His long marches were perhaps the most characteristic part of his career. Urged on by him, his armies seemed to be able to annihilate time and space. The rapidity of their motion was almost incredible. He was on the spot when his enemies believed him to be still hundreds of miles away. And when once arrived, Alexander had an eagle eye for seizing the moment to strike. He hardly ever made a mistake. His attacks, however reckless, succeeded to a miracle. So well compared to the leopard. The leopard is not a big animal. It's terrifically strong for its size. It's extremely fast, and it makes its attacks in just that way. Now, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. All the members of the family of Alexander the Great were assassinated in the struggle for power. So Egypt was taken over by his general Ptolemy the First. Thrace, the old Macedonia in Greece, was taken over by Lysimachus. Syria and Asia Minor went to Antigonus, and Cappadocia and Paphlagonia, which were eastern Turkey and the areas inland to the south of it, went to Eumenes. And it says, not in his power. That is, it was not an orderly division of the empire, but each quarter was simply seized by a local commander as his own independent act. So the accuracy of Daniel's vision here is beyond any question. Now we're beginning to get into what the symbolism of this thing means.